The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On November 6, 2007, the Korea Society hosted a lecture titled The Case of Arirang, How the Anthem of Korean Resistance Became a Japanese Pop Hit, by E. Taylor Atkins, an associate professor of history at Northern Illinois University. The lecture, given as a part of a one-day teachers' conference, followed the unlikely historical evolution of Arirang, a Korean folk song that became an emblem of Korea's resistance to Japanese colonial rule, and later, a pop hit in the country it protested against.
We're on. We're live. Okay. Welcome, podcasters. Welcome, teachers. I thank you to Mrs. Che for inviting me here. She's known that I've been working on this for a while and contacted me a while back. And then when this came out, the same week that the article came out, she contacted me and asked me to come speak. I'm always really surprised when a Korean organization asks me to speak because I come late to Korean studies. My specialty is Japan studies. I don't speak Korean. I read a little bit, but I've become, as I'm sure many of you are, converted to Korean studies for lots of reasons, and more than ever, convinced that one cannot really understand either Japanese history or Korean history without understanding the way that they're intertwined. I have a lot of colleagues in Japanese history who I'm astounded at how little they know about Korea, but it's really important that we study them in tandem, and that's really what I've been working on. I understand that you all have a copy of my article, so you can read it, and I will talk to you about it, give you an overview, and better than that, even play you examples of the music that you can't listen to in the article. But I did thought I'd begin with just talking a little bit about the background and of how I got into this and what the significance of it is, because it is part of a broader study. How many of you have been to Korea? Sweet. Okay, and I assume that many of the rest of you may get to go on the Korea Society's generous fellowship program. That's the kind of thing that got me into Korea. In 2000, the East-West Center, they do this every 2 years, actually. They sponsor faculty development programs where they take people to Hawaii for 2 weeks of lectures, which is really rough. And that's one of those hardship the efforts. And then 2 weeks in Korea. While I was in Korea, the first time we visited, we were in Seoul for about a week, but we went also to the southeastern part of South Korea, what was the old Silla Kingdom, and saw a lot of the monuments and artifacts there. We also went to the joint security area of Panmunjom, which has got to be the scariest place on Earth. Or one of the scariest places on Earth, and sort of this impromptu wildlife refuge because, you know, it's a DMZ and, the forest has reclaimed it and the animals, as long as they don't step on mines, they're okay. One of the things that really captured my attention was the Korean performing arts. My first book was on the history of jazz music in Japan, so it has nothing to do with Korean colonialism. But when I was studying artistic forms such as the talchum, the masked dance drama, which some of you are familiar with, or the pansori, or changuk operas. One of the things that I was taught was that these are traditionally have been an oppositional form of expression by Korean commoners, that they use these to express their grievances against the Yangban elites. And to satirize the existing moral order that oppressed them. I wondered immediately, coming from a Japan studies background, how did the Japanese react to this stuff? Because I'm sure that, you know, if Korean commoners were willing to parody and satirize and criticize their own countrymen in the elite social status, they were certainly willing and able to do that against the Japanese colonial powers as regime as well. And sure enough, they did. That was my main point of curiosity. And so I started exploring this more in depth, and a colleague of mine who has a background in English literature, she and I co-authored an article that I would characterize as a comparative musicology and literature study comparing Pansori operas and American blues. And I can give you the reference later if you're interested in that. But in the course of doing that research, I would come across cursory references to the suppression of Korean performing arts and folk culture during the colonial period. And there's nothing to get me started on a project than a cursory reference. You know, if somebody just mentions it in passing and oftentimes not even provide a footnote for where this comes from, you know, they make a broad statement, Korean folk culture was suppressed by the Japanese regime. Well, I'm going to go after that, and that's what I'm doing now. And in doing so, I'm trying to explore the sort of cultural impact that having Korea as a colony had on Japanese culture. And so this Arirang project is really part of a larger book that I'm working on that I call Primitive Selves, Koreana and the Japanese Colonial Gaze. And the term Primitive Selves comes from this part of the colonial ideology that Japanese believed that Koreans and Japanese came from the same racial stock. They had common racial ancestors. That the origins of Japanese culture could be found located on the Korean Peninsula, and because the Japanese had progressed through modernization and Koreans had not, they believed that when they went to the Korean Peninsula and observed the customs of the people there, they were actually looking at primitive Japanese or Northeast Asian culture, I guess, preserved intact, pretty much unchanged by historical time. And of course, this becomes what I would characterize as a double-edged sword. What is most well publicized, of course, is the Japanese arrogance and Japanese cruelty towards Korea. The sense that Korea was a stagnant society, and it was the Japanese imperial mission to bring Koreans, their distant cousins, kicking and screaming into the modern era, that they actually had a familial obligation to do this for Koreans. The other side of that, though, that I'm exploring in more depth in my book and that I allude to in this article is the sense of loss that Japanese feel when looking at Korea. Because they have colonial access to Korea and their own society is going through tremendous upheavals with economic modernization, industrialization, capitalization, the introduction of constitutional government, and modern conscript military, and all the things that go along with modern nation building, that there's a profound sense of having given up something valuable. And if when they look at Korea, they see that some were preserved in some kind of state, number one, they're willing to take advantage of that because that's what enables them to conquer Korea. But on the other hand, they want to document it, and they look nostalgically at Korea as the key to providing answers to Japanese own sense of primordial self and Japanese origins. And they do this through a variety of ways, what I'm particularly interested in is, like, I've written a chapter about colonial anthropology. Lots of Japanese ethnographers, ethnomusicologists, sociologists, art historians, people in varieties of humanities and social sciences field just came to Korea, and they gathered Korean documents and published a multi-volume history of Korea, much of which is regarded by Koreans as being a distortion of Korean history because it backs up a lot of the colonial ideologies of stagnation and Korean backwardness and things of that nature. As Dr. Ledyard mentioned earlier, it even created this whole mythical ancient history in which Japan at one point ruled parts of the Korean Peninsula. if you ever have an opportunity to go to Independence Memorial Hall, which is a remarkable museum devoted to the history of the colonial period and Korean resistance. This is in Chonan. It's about an hour and a half bus ride from Seoul or from Incheon Airport. They have preserved this gigantic stone with a Chinese inscription on it, which has been demonstrated to be a forgery, but which Japanese archaeologists supposedly discovered and claimed was evidence that Japan at one time had a small colony in Kaya or Mimana, I think it's called as well, in the southern tip of the Korean Peninsula. And it's preserved right there for you to see. It gives you some indication of how Japanese distorted aspects of Korean history. But in other ways, they were also doing work that nobody else was doing. And some of what they, for instance, work on Korean shamanism or musok. Japanese ethnographers with Korean assistants were going out and gathering these shaman songs and publishing them, documenting them. And there's this two thick volume study published by Japanese in 1937, 1938 that remains a standard work that anybody working on Korean musok has to consult that. It's just an inescapable fact. What's her name? Hyung-il Pei is a Korean historian and archaeologist who has written a fabulous book called Constructing Korean Origins, which documents the contributions that Japanese made to the study of ancient Korean history. Very much like the French so-called discovery and restoration of Angkor in Cambodia. It's an inescapable fact of history that Japanese were very interested in Korea, if only to suit their own purposes and to support their own mythos that they developed. It still remains the case. But the other thing that I'm interested in, and that this Arirang chapter or Arirang article forms part of a chapter, is I think that currently everybody here probably knows that Japan is experiencing what they call the Kanryu or Hallyu in Korean, the K wave, a Korea wave. This remarkable popularity of Korean popular culture in Japan. And a boom in the study, Japanese studying Korean language, going to Korea as a tourist destination, it's just really, really overwhelming. And many people, of course, locate it with this TV drama, Winter Sonata, that some of you are aware of. But as somebody, with my background, who whenever I go to Japan, I go to the record stores. That's just what I do. I noticed it from doing that in mid-1990s and then the mid-2000s, the K-pop section of Korean popular music section of the record stores has just expanded exponentially. Japanese are falling over themselves to buy Korean music and to watch Korean movies and Korean TV dramas and things of that nature. One of the things I'm trying to argue in my book is that this is not unprecedented, that in the 1930s, maybe on a reduced scale, you had a similar interest in Korea, or Koreana, as I call it for shorthand, in the Japanese popular culture of the time. It was part of a much larger interest in areas that were coming under Japanese imperial domination, because you have similar interest in China. And later on in Southeast Asian cultures as well. But that Korea was very prominent in this, and the chapter that I'm writing is built around the popularity of Arirang. As you'll see at the end of the article, I compiled a discography well over, in the decade between roughly a decade between 1931, when the first recorded version comes out, and the middle of the Pacific War. Well over 50 versions just in Japanese alone. That's not including versions produced by Japanese, but sung and performed by Koreans. And then you add to that the popularity. One of the you know, hands down most popular female celebrities in Imperial Japan was the dancer Choi Sung-hui, who some of you may be familiar with. She did an American tour and a European tour in the late 1930s. Sang-mi Park has written a really interesting art piece about how she was basically, you know, used by Japanese foreign policy to promote Pan-Asian ideals and the growth of the Japanese Empire, and try to generate a degree of understanding in the United States at roughly the time that the Japanese were destroying China, Eastern China, and was getting criticized roundly for that. So she becomes kind of a cultural ambassador, a cultural diplomat for Imperial Japan, but doing so as a Korean, performing traditional Korean dances. And that's the thing that the Japanese loved most. I mean, she did everything. She did all kinds of modern dances, and later incorporates different aspects of Asian dance and blends all of these things. But the things that really make her popular among Japanese audiences are her Korean dances. So that just provides some context for the essay. How many of you are familiar with Arirang? You probably can even sing it. Some of you, okay. That's great. My favorite Arirang story is two years ago I was in Cambodia, and I was going through Angkor Wat. And I don't know if any of you have been to Cambodia, but the Siem Reap, which is the closest city to the Angkor area and where everybody stays if they're going to Angkor, that's where the hotels are, is basically a Koreatown. Lots of Korean tourists go to Cambodia. Don't know why, but the hotels have signs all in Korean and everything like that. And my friend and I went to Angkor, and we were going to Ta Prohm, which is the part of the complex which has not been restored, which has basically been reclaimed by the jungle and left as was, as the French found it. And there were a bunch of Khmer musicians sitting there on the path playing traditional Khmer instruments. They were people who had been disabled by landmines. They had been, and that's how they were making their living, playing traditional Khmer music for tourists who come to Angkor. So my friend and I stayed a little, we're standing there watching their performance for a little while. One of the musicians looks up and he sees a big group of Koreans coming, and he spotted them a mile away. And on a dime, they stopped the song and started playing Arirang on Khmer instruments. And of course, the Korean tourists just went wild. They started clapping and singing along, and it was, you know, and having just been working on this, and, you know, I was like, yes, here we go, the Pan-Asian song, Arirang. The thing that I argue in my paper is that Arirang, during the colonial period, was perhaps the most well-known piece of music in the Japanese Empire. Because the Korean diaspora at that point was spread out in different places, like, you know, you have the provisional government in Shanghai, you have Korean migrant laborers and agricultural settlers going into Manchuria there in Japan. Because Taiwan is integrated in, because of this dissemination of mass media technologies with the Japanese Empire, Arirang is sung and known everywhere, at least in the East and Northeast Asian parts of the Japanese Empire. And then, of course, as I said, it even gets as far as Southeast Asia at some point. And I try to look at Arirang with a different set of eyes. Usually people who look at it are interested in its folkloric origins and those, depending on who you ask, it either dates from the mid-19th century or from the 9th or 8th century of the Common Era. Some people argue that the name Arirang doesn't mean anything. Others will argue that, well, no, it's the name of a hill. It's a name of a woman. It's a name of, you know, various things. And other people will say, no, the song precedes that, and somebody later on named a mountain Arirang or named a woman Arirang or something. So nobody can really agree on that kind of stuff, and I am certainly not qualified to even get into that. But what I argue is that the versions that we know now are modern, and they describe modern conditions. They describe the convulsion and the dislocation that people feel in the modern world. But that because of the special characteristics of the song, It's so malleable that it can be used both by the colonized and by the colonizers to express emotions that are unique to them, and possibly in some ways create sort of an affective bond between them, an emotional bond, something that's shared. That, you know, is much more effective than any of the draconian measures that the Japanese try to impose to make Koreans feel like they are part of the Japanese Empire and not their own separate nation. Okay. The qualities, am I still on? Okay. The qualities of the song that I'd like, that I highlight, are the fact that there is no one arirang. I mean, I refer to it as a song, but I only do that out of convenience because there are many different versions of arirang, as many as there are, you know, regional variations in dialect and culture in Korea. I note in here some, like at a Japanese ethnomusicologist, Kusano Taeko, who goes to Korea, and she presents what many people regard as the standard arirang to a group of people in, I think it was, I forget which province it was. Maybe Jala Namdo, and okay, right. And they start laughing. That's not arirang. But and so that really complicates it. And people from different regions outside of the Seoul, you know, they call the so-called Bonjo arirang or standard arirang, they call it Kyonggido arirang. They don't want it to be considered standard. They want it to regionalize it. No, you know, they. It's just like the way Tokyo dialect became Hyojungo or standard Japanese. They reject that and they say, no, that's just another regional variation. And I'll start with that. This is the version that's best known. It's the one that provides the template for the earliest Japanese versions. And it's many people consider this version to be sort of standardized by the filmmaker Naungyu, who did a very popular film in 1926 called Arirang, about a young man who's driven mad, and many people have characterized this film as an expression of Korean nationalism, and more recent scholarship and success has suggested no, it's just a basic melodrama about filial piety and lost love and things of that nature. And we'll never know because the film is lost. If one is discovered someday, maybe we'll have an idea. But there was a novelization that Kim Rolseal, who's a film scholar, looked at and found that, well, no, this is pretty much just basically a melodrama. But the theme song, because this was in the silent film era, the theme song was passed out on sheet music with lyrics to audiences, and they would sing together this theme, and this became therefore the basic the most well known version of arirang.
Arirang.
To this one are located on 659 of the article. Okay, just to give, I'll play a couple of different Korean regional variations so you can get a sense of how different this sounds according to region. And we'll start with Chindo Arirang. This one sort of highlights the probable origins of arirang as a work song, because you have a solo singer, Ondo, who sings the different verses, and then there's a collective singing of the chorus. And so many people have argued that arirang began as either a rural work song or a work song sung by construction workers who were rehabilitating the Gyeongbok Palace in the mid-19th century, drafted as forced labor, basically, by the Korean royals. The next one I'll play is Gangwon-do Arirang. This is from North Korea, okay, and performed by a DPRK ensemble. Socialist, doesn't it? Stalinist. Okay, so that just gives you a sense of the variety. Now, the variety, I say, is important because it makes, you can change the song to suit conditions. You can change the song, anything can be an arirang as long as you maybe preserve the term arirang in the refrain. You can improvise new lyrics based on, you know, emotions and circumstances that present themselves. So it makes it very malleable. And therefore, you know, I think it's problematic to argue, as many scholars have, that arirang is just an expression of Korean nationalism, because it can be that, but it can be lots of other things. It can just be, express the same kind of prosaic emotions that most popular songs do about lost love or longing for one's hometown or things of that nature. So it's not inherently a political song, but it can be made into such. In the article, I have several examples of how that were collected by folklorists. Most of this done after liberation, because anything that was oppositional, it would be difficult to either collect that or to publish it during the period of colonial rule. But on page 655, there's much rice in a rich man's granary. Many beggars fill one street after another. This one's really great, I think, for its rich metaphor. Poisonous grass grows before a virtuous woman's gate. A peony flower blooms before a whore's gate. It's describing a world, an unjust world, a world turned upside down, in which there is no justice. I love this one. Though wearing hemp cloth, I stare you down, dandy scamps. This is a reference to people who have become modernized in their clothing and their manners and such like that, and lord it over or feel superior to just regular old-fashioned rural folks. All usable trees were sold as telegraph poles, all pretty girls as entertainers. Talking about the violence both to the landscape and to the women of Korea that results from Japanese colonial rule. Above that, you have a quote from Kim San, who is a Korean socialist resistance fighter against Japanese rule, in which he constructs this myth about the role of arirang as being a song of opposition to oppression, the fact that it was sung by people who were on their way to their deaths for rebelling against the regime. So the people learned it, and after that, whenever a man was condemned to die, he sang this in farewell to his joys or sorrows. Every Korean prison echoes with these haunting notes, and no one dares deny a man's death right to sing it at the end. This is interesting. I mean, I hadn't really made this connection until just now, but the filmmaker Na Eun-gyu is supposed to have learned the arirang song that formed the basis for his movie theme from listening to dissident students who had been imprisoned by the Japanese for their participation in the March 1st movement, listening to them sing the song. And at that point, so he adopts it as the theme song, because in part because it's so familiar, but also because it expresses defiance. Professor Ledyard mentioned earlier the Uibyong, the righteous armies, the guerrilla armies that fought against the Japanese regime. And on 656 and 657, you have examples of lyrics that were sung. But these are, so I call them martial arirangs. They're calls to arms. They're they I don't know if they sang them, you know, like the when they're doing drill like they do in the U.S. You know, I don't know, but I've been told, or anything like that. But certainly they try to dramatize the injury that's been done to Korea, and to hearten not just the soldiers but their families to struggle against them. It's a very sort of well known tactic. I was in Japan doing research on arirang when I saw Fahrenheit 9/11, and I remember the very striking scene in there where the soldiers are pumping themselves up for battle by listening to heavy metal music or thrash, you know, really fast aggressive music, and I was thinking, well, you know, maybe it doesn't sound exactly the same, but maybe Koreans got themselves psyched up for battle by singing these arirang songs to get them ready. Now, there is some evidence that arirang songs that are called, that we would call Hangil arirang or Konichi arirang in Japanese, basically anti-Japanese arirangs, that they would be suppressed. There doesn't seem to be any systematic effort, because it's very hard to catch a song as elusive as arirang. Sometimes it could use very subtle kinds of metaphors to critique the Japanese, and sometimes they wouldn't be very blatant. But there is evidence, like in songbooks, of lyrics being blacked out that were just a little too on the nose for the Japanese taste in their protest. Others could be much more subtle, and they could get away with it. But one thing that is undeniable is that Japanese were fascinated by the song and took to it. And some of the most popular songsmiths of the imperial era latched onto this song, and once they had hit versions with it, it became arirang became something of a brand name. You could guarantee, to some degree, you could guarantee sales by doing in Japanese and Korean music markets by doing a version of arirang and playing with it. And to some degree, I would characterize, I mean, not everybody agrees with this. Kim Shiop, in his artwork on arirang, accuses the Japanese of deliberately distorting the song, trying to neutralize its nationalist impact, its indignation, by taking it away and corrupting it in somehow. But, it's hard to corrupt a song that doesn't have any single essence or version anyway. I mean, it's going to be changing anyway. And the Japanese, with all the musical means at their disposal, basically in the same spirit, continue to alter and rearrange and change this song in multiple ways. Now, usually when they do so, they do it to fit, particular kinds of pop music formula, like in particular, Lover's Parting, or the longing for hometown, or this is the basic pathos of life. It's just something that Japanese never get tired of writing songs about, and this Korean song, because it often expresses those same similar kinds of emotions, seem to do that very well. There's pleasure in the exotic. There's pleasure in when you're a colonial master. There's pleasure in identifying aspects of the foreign culture that you dominate and bringing them in and just exploring that aspect of it. I think Japanese had many, many motivations for being attracted to arirang. It's a catchy melody. It's a neat song. There's just that. But then there's also the pleasure in the exotic that I mentioned earlier, and as well as the nostalgic function that it serves, which I'll go into in just a minute. I've not found any evidence to back up a conspiratorial kind of effort by Japanese to wrench this song away from Koreans and denutralize it or neuter it so it's not an effective form of nationalist indignation. I I know that some people would say that, but I think that's giving Japanese far too much credit, actually, for forward thinking about cultural policy. I think it's much more basic than that. The people who were doing this are not the government. They are professional songwriters and musicians who develop an affection for this particular song, also for the Korean ballad, Doraji Taryong, the Bellflower song, and other aspects of musical aspects of Koreana, and then, you know, want to present it in a form that's palatable and intelligible to Japanese audiences. I'll begin. I'll play the next selection. I'll play will be the first Japanese arirang from 1931. It's at the top of page 660 by Saijo Yaso. And the sheet music for this, which I was so delighted, I found in a music specialty bookstore in Jinbocho, which is the used bookstore area of Tokyo. I couldn't believe my luck, but I found this. It's on page 671 if you want to look at that. This is the version by Kobayashi Chiyoko, who uses the pseudonym Kin Iro Kamen, or Golden Mask, for this version. Let's see. Anything you notice musically about that that strike you? That's worth commenting on. I'm sorry.
Very melodic.
Okay.
It doesn't sound traditionally Japanese.
Okay. Why not? What about it? Doesn't.
It sounds more European.
In what way?
In the melody, I was thinking Italian.
Okay. It does use a pentatonic scale for the melody, which is quintessentially, you know, Asian. But yes. Glockenspiel, I think. Yeah, or xylophone.
Yeah,
that's
called.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which I'm not used to.
Right. Right. It's arranged as a waltz. Mm-hmm. Okay. All Western instrumentation. And the reason for that is because Japan was a very cosmopolitan music environment in this period. Western music had become the standard form of the basis for music education in Japan for a couple of generations by this point. At this point as well, there's tremendous interest in all different kinds of music, from Argentine tango to the chanson from France to American jazz, you name it, Russian ballads, you name it, that you could get it. You could get Beijing opera and Italian opera. You could get anything in Japan at this point. And as this example suggests, and the other examples I'll play for you suggest, Japanese, when they adopt arirang, they place it within, you know, what I would consider to be the Western imperialism, you know, the music that results from Western imperialism, that, you know, that totally remake it in that way. The first bonjo arirang I played for you is. The meter is sometimes it's rendered as 9/8 in Western notation, but in Korea musicology it's called semachi, and it's 1 2 3 1 2 3 1 2 3 4 1 2 3. okay? But here, they just waltz it. And actually, Naungyu did that too for his film. That when the music that would be passed out as a part of the program was rendered as a waltz, and just so right there, there's a fundamental transformation of the song. Another contextual item about it is that Arirang represents an example of what Japanese called Shinminyo, and it's basically the same in Korean, Shinminyo, that means new folk song. And there, that meant two different, it could connote two different things. It could connote real folk songs, you know, taken from the oral tradition that are rearranged, recorded, presented as new popular music, okay, just like any kind of popular song. But it also could represent new compositions that are written in what was, you know, however you define it, a folkloric style. You know, new songs that sounded old, I guess you could say. And there was a market for these Shinminyo. In my book about jazz in Japan, I talk about big band arrangements of Chinese and Japanese folk songs that were made in the 1930s. So Arirang is very much fits in well with that particular trend. The next one I want to play is a couple of decades later, but it gives you a sense of how Arirang is reinterpreted using all these different cosmopolitan musical sources. I think you'll enjoy this. Is Arirang Blues, which was by Hattori Ryoichi and Saijo Yaso. It doesn't sound anything like a blues. If anything, the rhythm will suggest an old John Wayne movie. But it's very fitting that Hattori did this. Hattori was considered to be, characterized himself as the creator of the Japanese blues. It just shows the kind of the variety of musical elements that he and others were able to bring together to reinterpret Arirang. They do say the word Arirang, but the melody is not at all the same. And you might wonder, well, why do it at all? And I suggest to you that it's because Arirang was a brand name by this point that had proven its saleability, its marketability. Okay, again, this is lyrics by Saijo Yaso, who went to Korea specifically to find material for new Shinminyo compositions. And this shares a lot of characteristics with other Japanese pop songs at the time in the imperial era that would be called fukemono, or scenery songs, and are designed to evoke sort of the landscape and the essence of areas that had come under Japanese colonial domination. As Edgar Pope writes, these are images expressed by noun phrases rather than complete sentences, which makes them a bear for me to translate. to create loose symbolic frames within which the foreign can be imagined, liminoid spaces where the listener can play with exotic images and sensations. So the lyrics here refer to Korean top goats, chogori, and refer to the royal garden of Changkyeongguan. And but you know, there's other aspects of it, like the violin sounds like the Chinese bowed lute, the huqin. I'm sorry. The rhythm has that covered wagon feeling, you know, like you're watching a western, and it's supposedly a blues, and it's supposedly an arirang too. So there's just all kinds of you know, ways that that song has been totally remade in Japanese context. Now, the last thing I'd like to talk about is basically about the way that arirang fires the colonial imagination in Japan, the images that it evokes, and the importance of it. The first version I played for you, the first Japanese version, was written by Koga Masao. And if any of you are familiar with the very mawkish genre of Japanese music called enka, Koga Masao is considered to be the father of enka. His melodies, which were called Koga Merodi, are supposedly really, really, you know, sad. He openly admitted that he was inspired by Korean folk music in developing this style. And so that provides a lot of ammunition for people who argue that this quintessentially Japanese song form, enka, has Korean roots. He actually grew up in Korea after his father left or died. I can't remember. I think his father died. And then they moved to Korea, like many other Japanese, because they thought it would be a more hospitable economic environment for them. Not long after his version became a hit, he wrote an appreciation for it in a very high-profile intellectual journal called Kaizo. Says that the defining characteristics of all Korean folk songs is their eerie overarching pathos. He writes, "Smoke rising from the ondol, which is the Korean floor heating system of the houses at twilight, when the air is veiled as if a thick fog had descended, tiny insects chased by the smoke singing in one's ears. One often hears of such settings in the lyrics of disconsolate folk songs. Farmers at rest croon these." And this is my best attempt at translating Ure Ushi no Koe, "with a woebegone cow's voice, with an earthly odor." Nobody corrected me on that. This has been peer-reviewed, okay? But from such conditions, beloved songs are born and sung. One of the most striking things he says here is Korean folk songs are superior to Japanese folk songs as musical art. Now, I would locate this as part of a more broad critique of modernity that's going on in Japan at this point, a sort of self-contempt because a sense of loss for that is the result of Japanese modernization. Koga Masao is writing at a time when music making in Japan has been totally transformed by recording technology, by commercialization, by radio broadcasting. And he, of course, is a beneficiary of that and becomes very rich because of all that. But on the other hand, he also laments a perceived past in which people just sang from their guts and they didn't worry about an audience and they were sincere and they weren't worried about selling records or any of those things. And the songs really expressed their feelings rather than the desire to make money by coming up with a formulaic hit. And, you know, that remains sort of Koga's goal in life, to write pop songs that reflect that kind of aesthetic. But he contends that, you know, Koreans have been able to hang on to that because they're not modern, and laments the modernity that Japan has brought upon itself. And in that sense, he reflects or expresses a more widespread Japanese discourse on Koreana at this time, particularly articulated in the so-called Minge or folk craft movement of the time, in which Korean artisans are celebrated for their I guess you'd call it their simplicity, their artlessness, their lack of self-consciousness. This is all, again, a Japanese romanticization, a Japanese image. Therefore, part of being a colonial power for Japan, part of the responsibility is not just maintaining order in the Korean colony, not just extracting things like rice and resources and labor from Korea, and not just protecting the integrity of the whole empire, but also what I call curation, which means identifying, classifying, documenting, inventorying Korean culture, in part, not exclusively, but in part, because therein lies the origins of Japanese-ness. Okay? So the primitive self that has been ravaged by modernity can be recovered through curatorial efforts that the colonial power has the ability to do. And it's a desire to understand Koreans, the Futae Senjin, the Korean malcontents. Why aren't they happy that we're colonizing them? What's wrong with these people? To understand their worldview, the way they view the world. And one of the things that they come up with when they look at songs like Arirang is they say, well, geez, every song they sing is a sad song. It's not our fault they're sad. I mean, they're just sad. They're just a sad bunch of people. There's no way we're going to make these people happy. And I think that's one of the impressions that comes across. But also, the sense that there's something valuable that Koreans have to contribute to the empire through their culture, something that we Japanese, modern as we are no longer able to do. And I see this especially in the reaction, the response to Choe Sung-hui's dances, because many people in the late 1930s, early 1940s, many Japanese are saying, what she brings to the table, this Koreanness, is really important to the cultural integrity of the empire. And I say this to highlight what I believe is a basic contradiction in Japanese imperial ideology. There is, of course, and I do not mean to erase this at all, there is clearly a sense of Japanese superiority over Koreans and everybody else that motivates Japanese to do what they do. And this is clearly documented, and there's no point in even arguing against it. But I also think that there is a degree of malaise. And some people think that this phrase is too strong, but I would even call it self-contempt among Japanese because of their modernity, the feeling that the purity of their identity has been somewhat erased or effaced by modernity, and that other Asian peoples, because they are backward, are able to preserve something essentially Asian and thereby contribute to the culture of this new order that the Japanese hope to construct. The research that I'm doing now indicates that Koreana provided a really key way of understanding that primordial Asianism that they're trying to recapture that has been lost. So I think I'll stop there just in case you have questions. Okay? Yes, sir.
I'm wondering this issue of using Arirang as a subversive song. Were there any Japanese entertainers, writers, who may not have been in concert with the imperial view who use Arirang to support the Koreans?
I didn't put it that way, but I think that that's essentially what Koga is doing here. Not to question the validity of the colony itself, but rather to question and rebuke Japanese for maltreatment of Koreans. it's very difficult, even it's very, very difficult among anybody who's not a communist to find a Japanese who was willing to say that Japanese should not be ruling Korea, because it was a very mainstream sort of belief that it was in Koreans' best interest to be ruled by Japan. However, there were many, many Koreophiles among the Japanese intellectual community, among the administration, among people, you know, songwriters, Minge activists, who believed that Japanese rule was excessively harsh, and that Japanese people's behavior, the behavior of the Japanese community in Korea towards ordinary Koreans was inexcusable. They said, we say we're brothers and sisters with these people, and then we treat them with contempt. And they do try to raise, I think through promoting and curating Koreana, they do try to raise Japanese consciousness about the value of Korean culture, and at least to get Japanese to respect Koreans on a basic level that they feel that they're not being respected. That's not the same thing as advocating their liberation, but to try to make colonial rule more just and more benevolent.
My comment is that I think that you're onto something about this admiration of the Japanese by Koreans and the idea of their identity as Asians. And secondly, the whole idea of, if we can use the word soulfulness, I think contemporary Japanese, particularly among young people, are experiencing this in a very profound way of who are we, and that the admiration for this purity, this purity of identity and soul. I keep saying soul. I think there's a lot of
no regret. Pun intended, right?
Yeah, no pun intended. I think that they feel that very acutely.
Yeah, and I in the chapter that has developed from this, I quote, I believe it's a music producer in Japan who is talking about the current Hallyu and saying that, you know, part of the appeal is that Koreans are purer than we are. There is a belief that, you know, Koreans haven't quite gotten, and yes, they're a very modern nation, but they still hold on to basic core values of community and filial piety and than Japanese have. I frankly, having spent some time in both societies, would say, yeah, they haven't quite gone off the precipice of narcissism and self-indulgence and materialism that Japanese have, but they're getting close. And certainly that's part of the appeal of Koreana today to Japanese consumers. Yeah. Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have an opinion on Rain? I wonder why he's so popular.
I have no idea.
Do you know who Rain is?
No,
Rain is?
Uh-uh.
Never mind.
Sorry. Well, you know, what's the guy's name from Winter Sonata? Bae Young-jun. Yeah, he. You know, of course, when he came to Japan, Japanese women were just falling over themselves, and there are specific dating services now that are designed to hook Japanese girls up with Korean boys. And a lot of it's based on this notion that, and I think Korean women laugh when they hear this, that Korean men know how to treat a woman. that they're somehow, less domineering, less patriarchal than Japanese men. And so there are Japanese women who are actively seeking a soulmate, if you'll excuse the pun. It's not of my creation, but I love to use it. From Korea, because they think that they're all going to be like Bae Young-jun, you know, sensitive and hunky and all of this. That's one manifestation of the Korea wave. Yes.
I mean, it's kind of I've heard from Chinese people that professors in Chinese, in universities are saying that you have to watch Korean soap operas because among several Asian countries, probably Japan and China and Korea, Korea is the only country that still holds the Confucian value and ethics. Yeah.
Right.
So you have to, you know, watch the Korean drama. Probably right. That's what they're thinking about in Japan too.
Really, that's interesting, and it's not surprising. I mean, number one, there's a lot of animosity in China against Japan for reasons that need no elaboration. Korea's, in that sense, you know, they don't have the same kind of enmity. As long as you're not talking about how far Koguryo expanded into Manchuria, they don't mind. They don't have anything to fight about. But yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me because Korea is, you know, clearly an ultra-modern nation. It's the most internet-wired, you know, country in the world, and yet they're modern while still holding on to Confucian values. And this is actually has been part of Korea's self-image since the days of the Joseon Dynasty, that we have out-Confucianed the Chinese. You know, we Confucian relationships have reached their platonic ideal, their perfection in Korea, more so than the Chinese because they keep getting conquered by barbarians, and certainly more so than the Japanese, who are always outliers. And so that, you know, that merely reinforces that image, I think, yeah.
Thank you for listening to this Korea Society podcast. If you enjoyed it, please consider becoming a member. Members of the Korea Society are notified of all Korea Society events, enjoy discounts on admission to programs, and a complimentary subscription to the Korea Society Quarterly. Memberships may be purchased online at our website, www.koreasociety.org.